This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
Here we go.
That's all you can say. Here we go.
I've been talking about this since Friday afternoon when I emailed everybody. Texted Jen. I said, I'm coming at you Monday. And she said, bring it. So here we go. Robin Greek is with me as well. Chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, retired FBI and retired FBI, Jennifer Coffendaffer, in the left corner of the ring. Or I know it's like
that's
round
no
left one.
Matter, but it is.
Fight.
Right.
We're talking about the Lindsey Clancy case, and we will do it civilly, and we always do, and I love that.
Definitely.
And I think it's important because so many people who have been watching this case in depth, closely, like I know we have, a lot of people watching it passively, but it's created a rift in a lot of relationships and a lot of conversations, and it's okay. It's okay that other people look at things differently and understand things differently. What's not okay is just being like, screw you, I don't want to hear you. Like, let's try to understand a little bit where everyone is coming from. And at the end of the day, you can still disagree. And then you can say, screw you, I don't want to. No, that's not ever a good thing. But to actually, to get there, to understand how one person is going from point A to point B, that's what we're going to try and do today as we break down the Lindsey Clancy case. Your thoughts are welcome in the comments section, Substack and YouTube, wherever you're watching us. The links are in the description. Okay, let's get into this. The defense of the Lindsey Clancy trial has rested. Their final witness was Dr. Philip Resnick, the psychiatrist who helped acquit Andrea Yates. And he told this jury Clancy was psychotic the day she killed her children. The prosecution answered with rebuttal experts of their own, starting with Dr. Avram Mack, who says she retained responsibility. Jennifer Coffendaffer, like I said, she is here with us to help break it down on her perspective. The guilt argument says she never told a doctor about the voice. And that's true. Her own expert admitted it on cross. But nobody in that courtroom is arguing that she was well. The prosecution's official position is mentally ill, but responsible. And Dr. Zeisel testified that a month before the killings, she went to a clinic paranoid, saying her brain was damaged and that she should end herself. Everyone agrees she was sick, as much as the prosecution said it won't be a referendum about mental health. How sick does someone have to be before you say, not responsible? It seems to be an issue here of where is the bars? Where's the goalpost on this? Jen, I'm just going to throw it over to you. Where is the bars on this? I mean, where are you on this, too? I think we all can agree somewhat that she was sick. Maybe not. I don't know.
Oh, I agree she was sick. Look, anybody who can take exercise ban and strangle the life out of their kids five and below is sick. This is the issue for me. And the bar is very simple. I see the goalpost. It's in bright neon. Was she in her mind understanding right from wrong? And could she have stopped herself? It's so simple. In other words, were there bats flying around in her brain and she didn't know where she was and she didn't know what she was doing and she wasn't making any sense. She was incoherent. She was a hot mess up here. No, that's not the answer, but that's my bar.
But that's not what psychosis looks like. What you're describing is not psychosis.
It depends on who you talk to, right? You have half of the people saying that are quote unquote experts saying she was able to determine that. You have Resnick saying no. But listen,
I'm saying psychosis isn't like sitting in the corner with bats flying around your brain. Psychosis can look very normal. It's more about where true north is for you, basically, at that moment in time. What I would say, the way I try to understand it, a state of psychosis would be like this. And I'm curious to get your thoughts. A compass. Remember back in the day, compasses? Most of us remember compasses. you know, you can be in an area where your compass reading can be off, where the magnetic pole is screwing up your compass. And you're like, but if you don't know that there's a magnetic pole that's screwing up true north on your compass, and you are not familiar with the environment or what's going on here, you may be thinking you're going north and you may be going southwest. But because that pole, your compass being off, is inaccurate, you don't know that. So you're going to keep following your compass because your compass hasn't screwed you up yet. It's taking you in this direction. You fully believe you're going in the right direction. There's nothing telling you that your compass is off until that pull ends, whatever it may be. And then you're going back, how the hell did I go, you know, 18 miles in this direction when it says I've been going this? And you're horrified. That's how I'm looking at what was going on in her brain that day.
Interesting analogy, Tony, but this is where it fails. At the point that you fall off a cliff, at the point that you put your foot in a ravine and lose your balance, at a point at which you do something that is detrimental to somebody else, that's when the wake-up call comes and you're like, no, I'm not going true north. I'm going due south. And she, in this process of murdering her kids, had all sorts of mud puddles and cliffs she was falling off of. And, you know, I'll get into my philosophy on this, but I just want to take what your question is.
Yeah.
This is, have you seen somebody in psychosis? Because I personally have. I'm going to give you examples. Number one, working the job. People who were psychotic based on their drug usage. These people had no, forget about north and south. They didn't even know who they were, what they were doing as they're picking their skin off, as they're, you know, trying to get their methamphetamine fix. One jumped from about a three-story window, not even a two-story window. By the way, he did just fine. These people are batshit crazy. Okay, so there's that I've personally seen. I have a relative, sadly, who still very much suffers from psychosis. She thinks the U.S. government is after her. She has pulled out her fillings. She has tinfoil on her walls. She wears tinfoil when she goes to bed. And there's no way to medicate her. There's no way to get her help because she's not a danger to herself or others. She just lives in this state of paranoia. It's really super sad.
But drug-induced psychosis.
That's not drug-induced.
Well, you just were talking about meth use, so that's where I went with.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Toby. The first example.
And then the other one. I mean, that's not postpartum psychosis. They're not the same sort of.
Cancer. There's so many different types of cancers. Like saying, well, you didn't die of your cancer because you had thyroid cancer. Oh, actually, you would die from that.
Saying you have colon cancer, but you didn't get breast cancer.
Psychosis, and this is postpartum, and even postpartum has many different manifestations. I want to also emphasize, these are my interpretations and assessments of what the actual professionals are saying, not me. I am actually synthesizing, and I'll go through when we get to it, my protocol for listening to the professionals with the experience in the area talking about these expert things as testimony, not my conjecture, and just what the experts are saying on this. And the arguments for against it from lay people in the audience like me are moot to me. I'm listening to the experts. I'm listening at Cross. I have watched every single testimony throughout this thing, and I have my criteria for agreeing and disagreeing with things. And there's just nothing on the area when it comes to anything having to do with the postpartum psychosis. It says she didn't have it. She definitely had it from my interpretation and assessment of what the experts have said, including the number one in the world, Resnick. I don't care how old you say he is. I don't care whether, and he did it 3 months after she actually committed it compared to Mac. Okay, 4 months after compared to 3.5 years after Mac and the other Yahoo showed up that have zero experience with postpartum except going back till 2001. He's a generalist. I mean, again, I listened to the entire thing. I am going to go, don't worry, I'm not having a stroke. The sun went down. it's pretty
I
good, isn't it?
I was a little worried.
Cloud. Jen, you're sitting a dark cloud against me. And I also want to, you know, so again, I'll get more into this in a second, but for everyone watching, I want everyone to understand before this even started, we all reiterated our love for each other. We're all good friends. We care for each other. And regardless of the outcome of this, I'm not feeling any differently towards Jen after this. But I very specifically said, I am 180% completely opposite of everything she said on this case, absolutely everywhere. But that's why we're here, to understand, so you all can understand where we're coming from. I am on the researcher side. I am on what they're saying. I'm on the preponderance of what the experts are saying on postpartum psychosis. And then I'm looking at the behavior arc. I'm looking at every single family member that knows her through her journaling, through her life, from people that wouldn't even, you know, if this was any other human being, wouldn't do this. So when you look at that totality, when you looked at the medical totality, when you look at everything you're seeing and presented, I'm like, the preponderance is there. So even people saying, well, anyway, I'll let it rest.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different sides to this. Let's talk about the planning on this. And a lot of this depends on what you believe of the experts that have testified, their history, their expertise. One of the experts that was brought in was an expert on the Andrea Yates case about the bands. Resnick. Andrea Yates planned to. She waited for her husband to leave, and then she drowned the five children one at a time, methodically, over an hour. A jury heard all of that and said, insanity. Dr. Resnick testified Clancy was following a command voice, same finding made in the Yates case. So if the planning didn't prove sanity for Yates, you know, does it prove it for Clancy? I guess it really depends if you believe Andrea Yates. I mean, I guess I should ask that question because it really qualifies where anyone would go with this. You know, what's your opinion on Andrea Yates, Jen? Was this...
Sorry, Tony.
No, yeah.
First of all, one point that I have to get squared away on this whole cancer analogy. I think it's a horrible analogy, and let me tell you why.
I researched it.
If you have cancer, which is this growth and spreading of cells, I don't care whether it's in your pancreas, whether it's in your breast, whether it's in your brain, that it has the same mechanism of injury, mechanism of taking over. It just starts in a different place. And so when it comes to psychosis, I will say it is analogous in this way. You guys are trying to say it's not analogous because you're trying to say it's because the body part. No, in my opinion, cancer is cancer. Still the recreation of cells over and over that kills you. And psychosis, it's psychosis, whether it started in one way or the other, it still means you are psychotic and have no control of your brain.
But it presents, that's not what psychosis also means. Psychosis doesn't mean not having no control over your body.
But cancer also, some cancers are more aggressive. Some cancers are less aggressive. Some will kill you in a couple of weeks or days. Some will kill you after 10 years.
The point is, that I feel about this is we all have experiences with various types of people. Sometimes you have people that have been in various types of psychosis, this or that, but it's like, that's not them. That's not who we're talking about over here. And it's not the same thing. I mean, because there's unless it's postpartum psychosis and we're talking about like Andrea Yates, where it comes very close, very same scenario. I don't think it's a fair analogy to talk about someone in psychosis because of meth use or because of underlying ongoing medical condition that torments them daily. You know, her falling in and out of psychosis here seemed to be fairly rare or if to ever, other than when this occurred. So they're just fundamentally different things. It's not the same sort of thing. So to say this person had it over here, great, but what does it have to do with this? That's kind of where I'm looking at, because it's easy to jump over to go, well, I saw it present this way, so that must mean it presents that way over here. It doesn't. It just doesn't. So I think that's important to understand, you know, the case, to understand where she was and how she was interpreting these things. We can all agree it's horrible, but is it the same as someone who's picking their skin away because they're in a psychotic state that's drug-induced? It's not. There's a theory that, she's a sociopath. She even Googled whether sociopaths can be treated. But a sociopath caught for murder fakes crazy to escape punishment. That's the playbook. Resnick testified the testing showed the opposite, no faking. And she downplayed her own symptoms as well. She wasn't trying to, yeah, I'm really crazy. Let me live this up more. If she was faking, I mean, there's tests for this. There's a Rorschach test. If she was faking, why was she downplaying symptoms instead of playing them up? Wouldn't that be the opposite of what one would be doing if they're trying to fake this?
Okay, sorry. Can I go back, though, to your question on Andrea Yates?
Yeah.
Get to this one. So on Andrea Yates, it's very important to understand that there were two trials, one in 2002 and one in 2006. Yeah. I was in Texas at that time. Many of us lived through this. My co-worker, Cindy Rosenthal, her husband, Chuck Rosenthal, was the one in charge of that trial.
Okay.
And so very much, I don't know if I want to say insider knowledge, but certainly knowledge of a lot of things that happened in that trial and what was admitted, what was not, what was deemed way too prejudicial. Of course, what happened with their expert sort of fantasizing about this Law and Order thing that got that thrown out. But it's very critical to point out that Resnick was the defense on both sides. And he didn't sway or have, you know, the influence he hoped to have in the first trial. They took the facts and so forth in the first trial and convicted her. So she was convicted. It got overturned because of one of the experts, their recollection about a Law and Order episode that didn't even exist.
Right.
It was in the making, by the way, and it did get made later. But my point on this is this. We get two different juries, everyone. Two different juries.
That's why it's tough.
And to say that, I mean, it's just too different, right? So it doesn't surprise me at all that there were two different outcomes. When you ask about Andrea Yates, ever since she was a teen, had serious mental issues, everyone. Please go back and research. She was bulimic. She was suicidal. She had so many issues before she ever got married and had kids. And boy, let me tell you, once she got married and had kids, it even went off the rails. She was schizophrenic. She was hospitalized. She was a hot mess of mental illness. Horrible. We can never, ever compare the two. When I compare them, it's to show how you can't compare them. Their backgrounds are completely different. If Lindsay Clancy had Andrea Yates's diagnoses of bipolar, of schizophrenia, of suicide, of everything she had, I would have likely a different view on this case.
But that does.
But you just, Jen, you just said it. You said Andrea Yates, and I agree. Andrea Yates had a lifetime of issues. Her first suicide attempt came after her third child. And so she was diagnosed, actually attempted to be diagnosed for an extremely long time throughout her life, which was not the case because it manifested differently in the post. So she had stuff that was going on prior to being postpartum. And then postpartum kicked in and threw a lot of kerosene on it with Yates. And I never compared it to Yates until other people compared it to Yates. And I was trying to show comparisons and actually a timeline when certain things were happening with Yates at the same birth times that were happening in Lindsay Clancy as well. In other words, the first suicide ideation happened around the birth, around the same type of child. It wasn't on the first one for Yates. It was on the third. And for Lindsay, same thing. It happened later on. So all I was doing was there's more comparisons that you can draw between the two than not.
So Jen, she does have, I mean, it may not be as long of a path as Yates did, but there certainly is, you know, in the very least in the months leading up. My conjecture is she's probably been undiagnosed bipolar for a long time. But in the months leading up, diagnosed incorrectly. I mean, that happens, and it certainly appears to have been what happened here. Getting the wrong types of medication, so she was diagnosed incorrectly with generalized anxiety and anxiety and depression, basically, and being treated for that with drugs that interact basically the opposite of what you want if you actually have bipolar. It works against you, and that's what was going on with her system. The S-ideation, that's all there. That she did have that. So, I mean, I guess she did have those qualifying things you were just talking about, Jen, leading up to the actual event.
Not diagnosed mental illness. Look, she was
struggling. It was mental illness. It was depression and anxiety. It just wasn't bipolar.
And back to your point about these meds, this is critical to understand that 4 years later, 3 years later, 4 months later, if you look at the list of the different meds she was on per the testimony, mm-hmm. Oh my God, it's the same medication except for Wellbutrin was added in. Other than that, it's still Seroquel. It's still a benzodiazepine. It's still a stabilizer. When I saw the list, I'm like, okay, that's exactly what they had given her anyway. Now, I don't know about the exact dosages. They didn't get into all of that.
Well, it's up and down, and it's on this, it's off that.
I mean, it's so important to understand what was in her body at the time. And all it was dosages that were therapeutic.
But nobody's arguing toxicity.
I'm just saying everybody is. Everybody's saying,
it's incorrectly being argued because that's not the point.
That's very rare. But let's go back to the original question that we're talking about, though, is the malingering aspect of it, her faking it and over-exaggerating. But every single expert that testified, got it right here, not one of the medical experts, not one person at Room said at any point, was she faking? Was she exaggerating? Matter of fact, the test that she took says that she underreported things because she was an exaggerator. And so the thought process that she faked it, that she wasn't truthful, every single expert, both from the prosecution and defense, said nope, she was truthful throughout, no malingering whatsoever.
Okay, you ready, Robin? Ask you something 4 years from now, 3 years from now, 4 months from now. It is unrelated to how she was at that time. Period. End of story. When I'm interviewing
everyone in her life, also agreed. So you're saying that you are the one individual in her entire world that says that she's lying.
When I interview somebody, if they are under all of this medication and they're talking about self-serving statements, they've got this million gazillion dollar lawsuit open and everything else. It is so self-serving. The later ones, absolutely, Tony.
But Jen, you just made an argument that you're right and everyone that testified is wrong.
I'm not making a statement that I'm right or wrong. I'm making the statement that I do not put credence in a psychiatrist, a paid psychiatrist. Not that I don't think they are very good in their field. They are obvious experts. It was such an education for me, for sure, and I'm sure for lots of people, to just hear about postpartum psychosis, to hear about drug interactions, to hear about, generally speaking, it was very interesting testimony by everybody. But they don't know Lindsay Clancy. They sure as hell don't know her from that moment that she made those
her
decisions.
Her family does. But friends do.
Her family wasn't even interviewed. They didn't. The one
I meant for her life. Through all the, but all the people
didn't even talk to her husband.
All the people testifying didn't see it. And when it comes to congruence, so here's how my behavior team worked. And this is where my lifetime in the Bureau works, is that when we did a behavioral assessment, we assessed people for truth, veracity, and congruence and all these things. So we made the behavioral observations. Then my operational psychs, as a matter of fact, one of them is Dr. Chris Mahandi out on the West Coast, Dr. Reed Malloy. We had some of the best in the world that tested to make sure our observations were congruent with science. And so my 23 years of reps with the FBI of doing these assessments, when I was looking, I do my observation assessment. And so I saw nothing but congruency on the witness stand from her and nothing but congruency in everything time we see, again, we don't know her, you're right, in those moments, but when you take the preponderance of what the experts are saying, what they tested for, you take what I'm witnessing in the courtroom, and then you take what the people in her life are saying, which are the best indicators for anyone, are the people in your life. And there is not one blip that she has ever had anything of exaggeration. In other words, there's not one report anywhere that says she's a liar, she's an exaggerator. There's nothing. So this would be the very first time in her entire life that she did that. And that's what makes it incongruent.
She told everybody, I want to harm the kids. And nobody listened to her. She
right.
told her mother that. She told her father that. So
right.
by this premise, yeah.
Get she was truthful.
Away. She knew. She is the most responsible for this, obviously.
Absolutely. And the planning happens in psychosis. That's what Dr. Resnick described very, very well. It's not just command hallucin. I know you don't like Dr. Resnick now.
No.
But you did on Yates because he helped convict Yates.
No, he helped get her off. I mean, he didn't help convict.
I know. He helped defend her because of the
psychotic
rape.
One time, yes. One time, no. One time the jury bought it. One time the jury didn't.
But world-renowned expert on it.
On which jury you're looking at.
So who would you listen to on the stand if not Yates, if not Resnick?
Okay. In this situation, I would listen to anyone, Resnick, any of them. Mac, if they would have interviewed her, and I understand all the legal issues involved in this and how long it takes. I totally get it, how long it takes to get the expert on board and blah, blah, blah. What I'm saying is I would listen to the people who diagnosed her, who met with her at in and around the time of the murders. I can't go 4 months later. No possible way. And medicated and talked for a whopping 3 hours. I've conducted witness interviews of a loose witness. In other words, that wasn't the one that hinged on whether the case was going to result in a conviction or not for more than 3 hours. I mean, gang investigations, 5 hours, multiple times, 10-hour interviews to get information. You're going to hinge your decision on this case, Robin, based on a 3-hour interview to a medicated individual 4 months later by an 88-year-old who, by the way, forgot where he interviewed her.
I'm going to base it not on him. I'm going to base it on him. I'm going to base it on all the other testimony. I'm basing it on my own observations. I'm basing it on every single person in that courtroom that has been testifying. I watched it. I evaluated it. I assessed it. And again, it doesn't matter what I think anyway. It's just what the jury's going to get, which I think is going to be on the jury.
At the same point, Jen, too, the expert for the state that came in at the end here,
Mac.
Didn't talk to her for like 3 years or after. And again, a very short interview. So I'd put about the same sort of weight there, too. I mean, even worse because it's so far out, you know, years later. What was it like 3 years ago at the worst moments of your life? Like, yeah, I mean, you're not going to get the most accurate either way. But overwhelmingingly, I would say, yeah, I mean, the experts here, you know, that have testified, I think have really laid out how this works, how psychosis works, and folks who've lived that world as their career path, working with people who are suffering from it. I don't know, it's been very compelling. Your thoughts in the comments section on Substack and YouTube as we continue this conversation.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Green.
Here we are, Lindsay Clancy. We're getting very close to closing arguments. And Wednesdays, as we always do, we are going to break into the psychological end of this case. Lindsay Clancy, of course, paralyzed from the chest down, has been under round-the-clock suicide watch since January 23. If the jury convicts, the most likely destination is MCI Farmingham, the oldest women's prison in the country, operating since 1877. Psychotherapist Siobhan Scott is with us to help us break all this down. What happens if she goes to prison? What happens if she stays in a mental health facility like Tewksbury? Where does this all go? We're going to talk about Patrick as well today. But let's start here. For 3.5 years, Lindsay Clancy has been a patient. Everyone around her, nurses, doctors, aides, exist to help her. The system has currently said, yeah, she doesn't belong in the county jail. She belongs in a mental health facility. A guilty verdict makes her an inmate, and everyone around her exists to contain her. Like I said, Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author with myself and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. I guess I want to start here. Why is it, Siobhan? I know this is probably a function of how our system currently works, but you have a system that currently has said this woman does not belong in a jail. She belongs in a mental health facility, and she's been there ever since, still is to this day. Why is it that what could happen next is a decision that is very much about mental health. It's very much about where she goes from here, that could remove her from a hospital-like setting where she is contained securely to something that is not that. And it's a decision about mental health that will be made by people who are not practicing in the world of mental health, just regular folks out on the road, jurors, making the decision about something so critically important that are not educated on it. That to me, it just seems bizarre. It seems strange, but I know this is how our system works. What are your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, I think looking at all the clinical evidence that we've been hearing all week, she's seriously mentally ill. She belongs in a place that's focused on support for mentally ill people and treatment. Now, prisons do have units or wards or whatever they call it, for people who have disabilities, whether they be severe psychiatric disabilities, health disabilities. They're not typically put in the general population, and I think that would not happen for her just because she's paralyzed. But it's not going to be the same level of care and the intensity of care that she's getting at Tewksbury, where she's at right now. And certainly from all the evidence, everything we've heard this week, she's severely mentally ill. And the treatment that she would get at Tewksbury is certainly ethically the right thing to do for her.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a real ethical conundrum. I mean, to me, like, that this is how it is how it works, Robin.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you, Tony. And what an insightful question. I'm not validating you for the sake of it. I mean, this is probably, I think, one of the harder, there's so many hard things in this, but this is one of the bigger ones for me as well, because as a jury, their job is not to think in terms of sentencing.
Yeah.
Yet their decision is going to impact the sentencing to this point. And so this is an interesting gap I'm seeing here, because to everyone's point, there's, like Siobhan said, there's not one mental health professional that's testified for either side that says she's well. And she's and which is an interesting observation. She has been in a facility for mental health since she committed a horrendous act.
Yeah.
And yet, based on 16 people, 16 or 18? I'm sorry.
18.
18. Someone else is going to make the decision who's not a clinician on where she spends the rest of her life. Or if she's found not responsible by reason of insanity or whatever, it'll be an undetermined amount, but definitely for the long foreseeable future. So that's a very, very interesting ethical question.
It seems like an odd place for the road to split and for who's making that decision, where it's not a medical professional making a medical decision for someone, but based on a judicial ruling. But I mean, it is what it is. Let's talk about
one more thing, Tony. So here's a bit of hope I have in this one. Again, I use that word hope in places maybe sometimes where you shouldn't. I like the judge in this, you know, and so he's going to be one that's in charge of sentencing. So let's, no matter what happens in the outcome, I'd be really fascinated to see what happens next. And also we know Reddington's made enough smoke and fires throughout this thing that there's going to be a large number of appeals on whatever the outcome is, if it's not
helpful
to them.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. If she were to be found guilty, it's just, this is not a patient or a defendant here that necessarily has the...
Should be in Gen Pop.
Yeah, that I think has the gusto to survive years and years of appeals or anything like that. I mean, I think she's fragile as hell.
Good point too.
Let's talk about what it looks like in a facility. Siobhan, you had said that, you know, it's probably not going to be Gen Pop. This is a woman who can't get from her bed to her wheelchair without two mm-hmm. people lifting her. Mm-hmm. In a hospital, being that helpless is safe. In a prison, mm-hmm. she'd be defenseless in a building full of women who, you know, may despise what she did, may not have the most understanding for what happened. What sort of, I mean, granted, even if it is, best case scenario here, she's not in Gen Pop, she's in a segmented area. What does that actually look like behind bars? What kind of dangers does she face? What's the reality of what this would be if she goes behind bars?
Yeah, I don't know that, I would doubt that a prison is going to have her with people monitoring her in the same room and being with her for support 24/7, which is what she's had. And how much time is she going to be alone? We know that the urge to unalive herself is still very, very strong, which is one reason that they're watching her so closely. And I'm guessing that she's getting some supportive care from those people watching her. And so that would be, I think, absent in prison to that degree. And so her odds of survival would probably go down because there are going to be more opportunities for self-harm.
And not just that, but general population harm. Even if she's segregated to some, I tried as well to do some research on where she might wind up if she's convicted. And the outlook is not good, you know, because mm-hmm. she's going to be vulnerable because of being paralyzed and also because of the self-harm issues that she's continually dealing with, especially, I mean, everything's kerosene on that fire for her right now at this point. And then you actually have the act of what she did herself with the filicide, which actually makes her another target as well. Yeah. Because as divided as we are here on the outside about how we feel about her on the mental health side versus the other population side, the same thing is going to exist in there as well, mm-hmm. except they have more vitriol towards it potentially.
Well, quite often when it comes to S-Watch or ideations and such, it's not that, you know, in a jail setting in Massachusetts, that individual is going to be put into, you know, very likely a lockdown type setting, a stripped down cell with not the means to do that. I mean, as much as they can reduce that, if you will, the chances of it. But I mean, when you're talking about, I mean, the goal is clearly not to help the person anymore. It's more so to contain the madness, if you will. It seems insanely inhumane. But again, this does happen every day to inmates that are suffering from mental health problems. But it is how we do it. We'll lock them away in a place where they can't necessarily hurt themselves. Does it ever really help anything, removing the objects or means to which someone could hurt themselves with and putting them into a quiet room where nobody else is around in a prison? Or does that tend to make things even worse for someone who's already on the precipice of psychosis?
Yeah. Isolation is very hard on people psychologically. And we know that they often deteriorate if they're isolated. So where she is now, I'm guessing that she has groups, she has activities, you know, productive activities, things that she can do and be involved in. She would have regular therapy. And so that's probably not going to be available to her. And so for her to survive psychologically in prison is just going to be a lot more challenging.
Yeah, what happens to that, Siobhan? You know, because everyone's right on this one about most likely being in isolation because of the self-harm issue she's dealing with. And so we don't have to even take a look at or focus on the hypothesis of her psychotic break. Just look at what all the clinicians agreed upon, that high SI ideation plus action, bipolar, either one or two, which I know mm-hmm. you're a much bigger expert mm-hmm. on that. I mean, all these mental health issues she's dealing with, what's that? Because I know, look, right now, observing her, looking at her, and even hearing some reports, she sounds stable-ish from what mm-hmm. we've seen. If mm-hmm. you put her in that kind of isolation, we know it's not good psychologically. Mm-hmm. What happens to her brain next? What do you think starts escalating from there?
She certainly could develop more symptoms. And She, you know, depression has been a significant problem, anxiety a significant problem, and that could certainly increase in a prison system.
What do you say, Siobhan, to people? There's plenty watching right now that are going and saying, she doesn't deserve group activities. She doesn't deserve anything that is beyond the basics. She killed her three children, the babies. What do you say to that? For folks who really have zero empathy, zero sympathy, zero care whatsoever for where she ends up, whether that be in a prison setting or a tank of sharks.
Yeah, we're seeing, as we've talked about, and I know you've been talking about it, the incredible lack of compassion. And I'd say a lot of it is sadistic, the things people are writing, and this urge to see her as a monster and to see her as miserable as she can possibly be. A lot of people want her eliminated, you know? It's troubling. I think there are a lot of troubling things about this case. It's a very painful case to listen to the testimony, but people are just acting out in rage about what they see, what they want to see happen to Lindsay. And that, I think, for me, it's been shocking and rather depressing and sad to see the lack of awareness and this vicious, vituperative desire to see her tormented. And it's unfortunate.
It's shocking, like you said, to watch people want to treat her and regard her like we're regarding Koberger.
Yes.
And it's like they're clumping those two people together, but they're apples and oranges different about what was going on inside that brain. And I think that's people's quick knee-jerk reaction, and then they double down on it because they don't want to contradict anything they say to or believe from the very beginning and onset. It's because of their lack of understanding. But it's pretty profoundly different.
And they won't listen to me. I know you've heard me say this probably 24 times, but I'll keep saying it in case new people are listening. And I just want to reinforce, a psychopath is not psychotic.
Right. Yeah.
A psychotic person is not a psychopath. And it just seems like, no matter how many times I say it, people that are invested in rage and punishment, they don't want to hear it, you know? I mean, they just don't want to hear the basic facts.
Is it because those folks are too close to actually being one or the other? and well, it's just flying too close to the sun, and it's just like, nope, can't accept that.
That would be a really interesting study. I think sometimes they're just people who, as we say, don't think in a sophisticated manner. They don't have an open mind. They can be addicted to rage, and they get this amped up, you know, people that are watching it for hours and hours and hours and are only in their bubble where everybody's saying the same thing. This just becomes their reality, and it's not reality. And, you know, they don't want to be confused by the facts.
It's an interesting way to watch it, too, because as you're saying, watch it for hours and hours and hours. I'm like, uh-oh, I'm watching this for hours and hours and hours. But here's an interesting take on it. Like, we were talking about this right before the show. In the last couple of days, especially with Dr. Resnick, and we agreed on this as well, for the prosecution, I'm watching for hours and hours and hours, and most times what we're seeing for these other people are like, see, I told you, because they're cherry-picking their own confirmation bias to prove their preconceived notions to fill in those gaps. Yeah. Meanwhile, I'm listening to Dr. Resnick, and I go, ooh, that's an interesting ad I hadn't thought of. You know, so there's a different way in which to interrogate that information and critically think through the things you're listening to. As I said yesterday, the greatest thing I think for people like us that try to critically think these things and also remain humble, the fact that I can be very wrong sometimes and oftentimes sometimes, is when we change our minds. You know, is being open to the fact that, wow, my mind can be changed on this, or at least waver, wobble, explore it more deeply. Because again, Resnick, I thought, and I know we'll get into it, just did a really good job of expanding things a little bit more and encapsulating, like you said, what all the clinicians are saying and can agree upon, even though each of them has their own specialty differences and experiences.
You know, an option we don't have here in the United States, and some countries do, is the choice to humanely self-exit the planet. And this is something that really hasn't been brought up in this case at all. She's talked about it several times. She doesn't want to be here. The only reason she's still here is because a lot of people that are not her have made sure that she kept herself alive. and removed the possibilities of herself exiting. Mm-hmm. Is this uniquely an American problem that we have with I guess being open to this possibility, where other places do this humanely, and it's not always just when someone is severely critically ill, if you will, you know, with cancer or something of that nature. Lindsay Clan, and it's a I know it's a very, you know, touchy subject for a lot of folks, but at the same point, in a case like this, where this has happened, she went through this hell. She's out of the psychosis now, and she's seen what the hell happened. There's no therapy. There's nothing that's going to like make me a whole human being. Yeah. There's nothing that I'm going to be, let me get on with my day and find something better to do. That's going to be worthwhile. Honest to God, in a case like this, is that something that should really be on the table for more people? Do you want to go through this? This is a circus show. And it's mainly for everybody out here. It's not for you. We're not teaching you a lesson. We're not putting you away so you learn how wrong of what you did was bad. This is someone, if we accept that she was mentally ill, she was in a state of psychosis, and she clearly doesn't want to be here anymore. What are we doing this for other than for ourselves?
It's a tough question. I have probably my own biases. I think if people are terminally ill with cancer, they're suffering, they've gone through treatment, there's not going to be a saving of them, and they're looking at a very long, lingering death, I fully 100% support it. I had a friend with ALS who, when it progressed to the point that she could not swallow and she could not speak, she made the decision, you know, for a medical assistance in dying.
Yeah.
100%, I get that. But when we get into mental health issues, I'm a little more cautious because, as I always say, I like to hold hope.
Sure.
Even in these dark cases, and I have hope that even particularly if she goes to Tewksbury or another psychiatric facility, that maybe over time she could regain a quality of life that made it worth living. You know, mm-hmm. maybe she would have something to say to the world that yeah. would help people understand this. So that's just my bias.
Sure. No, it's a fair argument. And I agree. But whose choice is that to make, I guess? Is that, yeah. I mean, it's a hope for those of us on the outside yeah. that maybe she could add something to such trite words, conversation, you know, that people have in our understanding of this from a perspective that only she can deliver, mm-hmm. Which could be very powerful. But again, you're asking her to continue to live yeah. when maybe she doesn't want to. Yeah. I mean, in so many cases, I mean, I totally understand where you're coming from, especially on mental health. This is one, though, where it's like, I can totally understand why you want out. Mm-hmm. and why essentially the rest of her existence on this planet is worse than living with a terminal illness, I would say, yeah. almost.
Yeah. I would say, though, at the same time, if she's found not competent to be able to be accountable for the action she took, being able to be competent enough mentally to make that choice as well is something I would say is an interesting challenge.
Medicated in her right mind?
But at the same
time, that's someone who's got their wits about them, that's making an educated right. choice. Just because someone chooses they want to do that doesn't mean that they're not, you know, in a mental state that,
right.
of competence.
So I did look it up, though, since we brought it up. You know what I do. No country has a recognized legal pathway that lets someone in cases like this self-execute or assisted euthanasia. The ones that do allow assisted euthanasia under very tight restrictions for, like we're talking about, medical reasons is like Netherlands, Belgium, Canada, yeah. Spain, and a few others. But it's under strict rules, very tight guidelines. But,
yeah.
But people in this type of situation are not eligible for those assists in any of those countries as well. So this does not exist since we brought up the hypothesis, which is
maybe it should.
Well, it's an interesting hypothesis, or thought experiment, I should say.
Yeah,
I hadn't thought about that before. It's interesting to think about.
I know. I mean, it's
tragic as well.
It's horrible. It's horribly tragic. And I'm not saying it is like anything light about it, but it's like, well, I don't know. Some cases.
And if you think about it, too, would it really serve the people that want to see her tortured? Because they wouldn't want her to be able to choose it. They'd want her to suffer through it. So I don't know if it would silence the sadistic ones out there anyway, or again, but it would only be to bring her peace. But there's so many aspects of this that I've never felt underqualified to speak on so many things except this case in such a long time on so many different areas. That's why I'm really leaning in hard on the medical professionals on this one, because there's like every day I'm learning a different little nuance, a different little difference. And that's why I thank God we have Siobhan with us today every Wednesday.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of emotions here. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Normally in these ads, you expect somebody to ask you to buy something, but this is something different. I'm Julian Barnes, and I'm a reporter for The New York Times. I'm a national security reporter, and that means I'm reporting on military operations. These are fast-paced, quickly moving situations. What exactly is happening on the ground is often shrouded in mystery, but we turn to trusted sources, satellite imagery, and expertise built up over years in order to ferret out the facts that wouldn't otherwise come to light. I'm here to ask you to seek out a news source that does firsthand fact-based reporting. If it's your local paper, great. If it's The Times, thank you. Because where you go for your information matters.